The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Rainmaker FM.
And thank you for joining us for another episode of The Writer Files. I'm your host, Kelton Reed, and in part two of this special edition of the show we call The Writer's Brain, a guest series with neuroscientist Michael Gribko, we'll dig into a phenomenon known as imposter syndrome, an experience many writers struggle with. The experience known as imposter syndrome has been recognized in over 70% of the population and across a wide range of demographics. Everyone from best-selling authors to A-list celebrities and even genius-level scientists have all admitted to feeling a kind of isolation from not wanting to be outed as a quote-unquote fraud, even though they're far from it. And it's not just limited to high achievers. It's been found in men and women across a wide range of groups, including those about to launch a new creative project or career, teachers, students, entrepreneurs, and many others. Across all demographics, success tends to create an even deeper sense of the imposter experience. And although not considered a clinical psychological syndrome, the effects can be debilitating to writers at any level of experience or professional standing. These feelings of self-doubt can snowball if not addressed and leave you with a sinking depression, anxiety, and even a sense of dread at taking on new or challenging tasks. Luckily, research scientist Michael Gribko returned to the podcast to help me find some answers about the origins of anxiety in the human brain and how to address the imposter experience from both a scientific and a layperson's perspective. And if you missed the first half of this show or any previous episodes of The Writer's Brain, you can find them all in the show notes, in the archives at writerfiles.fm, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you tune in. And do us a favor by taking a few moments to leave a rating or a review. Just let us know how we're doing. In part two of this file, Michael and I discuss why the writer as athlete trope undervalues the power of the human brain, small steps you can take to rewire your anxiety, how writers can harness their interactional expertise to beat imposter experience, why you don't need a PhD to sound like an expert, tips and tricks for overcoming your unfounded self-doubt, and why a page a day keeps imposter syndrome away. The Writer Files is brought to you by the all-new StudioPress Sites, a turnkey solution that combines the ease of an all-in-one website builder with the flexible power of WordPress. It's perfect for authors, bloggers, podcasters, and affiliate marketers, as well as those selling physical products, digital downloads, and membership programs. If you're ready to take your WordPress site to the next level, see for yourself why over 200,000 website owners trust StudioPress. Go to rainmaker.fm/studiopress now. That's rainmaker.fm/studiopress. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click subscribe to automatically see new interviews as soon as they're published.
Well, we've talked about solutions to kind of, and again, going back to that, the tired trope, which I've used often and a lot of writers use, writer's athlete, and why when we're talking about neuroscience, why that's not a great fit for instance, you know, okay, yes, athletes train to accomplish a goal, and as do writers, you know, they kind of work, you know, for years and years and years to get to a place maybe where they feel like their writing is effectual or something to that effect. So just going back to writer's block and how, you know, you can, we talked about solutions to how you can rewire, in a sense, your brain to overcome that sense of being blocked. So it makes sense that then we would be able to also rewire our brains to overcome imposter experience.
Right, right.
So,
and that's sort of, you know, got into that a little in the prefrontal cortex when people start recovering from anxiety disorders, we do see changes in the neuronal activity.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I know you talked about in writer's block, and maybe we could revisit just for a second and see how it applies in the writer's block episode about kind of, what is it? Avoidance,
yeah.
Motivation.
Avoidance learning approach motivated.
Yeah. So how you could kind of get into a vicious cycle
of avoidance
of not writing because you're thinking about it to the point where it gives you so much anxiety. You feel like there might be, an outsized negative consequence
and that's what's striking about anxiety is when it gets really bad, you know, we start perceiving our brain, the activity in our brain can get to the point where an everyday situation can be processed as if there's a threat in the room,
right?
You know, where we have like the neuronal response as if our life was threatened almost, you know, and this
sure.
is, you know, extreme cases like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and panic disorders, things like that.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's a big problem. And, you know, if that is happening, then, you know, good idea to seek some treatment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, no, back to the writer's block, you know, we talked about some little things you do and start, take some small steps where you can be successful and try to shift into a more approach motivated state. You know, you need to taste some success usually to do that. So if you're constantly failing, you're going to be starting to drift more into that avoidance motivated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll link to the writer's block piece that I also wrote recently, but I think just to turn back to the imposter experience and if you're feeling it, how we can start to reframe it to the effect of, you know, being able to overcome it. And I think you sent me a really interesting article. Maybe this is the time to talk about this great article that we were looking at specifically, what happens when we turn the world's most famous robot test on ourselves. So that's the one you sent over. I thought it was very interesting and actually wrote about it. So I'll link to this article where I started to try to parse out, you know, how we could overcome imposter syndrome.
Yeah, that's a really good, it's really interesting.
So my take on it was how this famous robot test can help you beat imposter syndrome. And I found that, I think what I pulled out of it, what the most important thing was this idea of interactional expertise. And we had talked a little bit about earlier, maybe we can revisit just the idea that maybe a writer starting out on a big project or being asked to write about something that they're not necessarily the subject matter expert on, or even, I don't know, writing a historical novel, for instance, where you need to actually be quite proficient with the details of the time, you know, kind of places maybe where writers are coming from where they feel like imposters because they don't have the maybe the information that they need.
Right.
So this interactional expertise I thought was a fantastic jumping off place.
And yeah. It's a good example of,
yeah,
you don't need all that tacit nuts and bolts knowledge to still be able to talk about something proficiently and convey information.
Yeah. Or to sound intelligent when speaking with those who may have.
With experts, even in this case. Yeah.
I guess the idea of interactional expertise is that it's the opposite of contributory expertise, which would be expertise acquired through traditional learning
experience. Direct experience.
Exactly. Yeah. But expertise nonetheless. So the article, going back to the original, was this great story of this. Well, I guess to go to the robot test first,
the Turing test.
Yeah. So basically Alan Turing, genius mathematician in the 50s. If you've seen The Imitation Game, that was actually the name initially of his test.
Yes.
Not to get into the specifics of his situation, but in the original test, if the examiner was unable to distinguish the computer's answers from a human's answers to a set of questions, the computer was deemed able to pass as human or as intelligent as a human, right?
Yeah.
So years and years later, social scientists turned the Turing test.
Collins.
Collins which you can talk a little bit about, to determine, they basically would use the test on a wide variety of fields to learn whether or not human subjects could use their ability to pass as members of groups that they didn't belong to. So basically using them to compare human intelligence.
And Collins actually did this. So he's a, as you say, a social scientist, sociology, and he studies scientists.
Right.
And specifically, he ended up, I think his department was close to a department with a lot of astrophysicists. So he started hanging out with these guys. And just over time, he became pretty familiar with their research, and he could talk about specifics and became sort of an outside expert in astrophysics and specifically, and this is a kind of cool side point, gravitational wave and, you know, gravitational wave. And he actually has a few books out there. He wrote books
on the subject.
Yeah. And they're on my to read list.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So a humble sociologist from spending many years studying these gravitational wave physicists basically was given a test to determine whether or not he could pass as one.
Right.
And none of the experts could out him as,
right,
as the, right, as, yeah.
It was something like eight people. Collins was one of them. And, you know, there were seven astrophysicists. And then Collins had one of his friends who's an astrophysicist write seven questions or something specific to the field of gravitational waves,
right,
handed them to everyone. Everyone answered them. And then all the answers were handed out to the astrophysicists. And I think only one of the seven pointed Collins as the fraud or the not the expert. Five were completely fooled, couldn't tell. And I think two of them were kind of up in the air.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So, I mean, I think the takeaway for that, for writers specifically, is that, you know, the interactional expertise part, you know, it's something that I think if you're speaking the language of whatever the audience is that you're speaking to, it's often very hard. And I think sometimes we also gloss over small, maybe, errors.
Yeah.
Because I think so often when you sound knowledgeable and you come across as kind of confident about it, honestly, like, when's the last time you were reading, say, a piece of historical fiction and then went to cross check it on, you know,
right,
in an encyclopedia or something like that? Just to make a small point on that. But anyway, I think the interactional expertise part is interesting because I think you don't necessarily need to be the subject matter expert to sound like an expert or to, right, sound like knowledgeable.
Yeah. You don't need that tacit knowledge to necessarily get the major points across.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was pretty fascinating to me. So I think the takeaway was that, you know, here was this lifelong student really who, you know, didn't have the specific education or the career credentials, right, but it didn't matter.
Yeah. He can still accurately talk about gravitational waves.
And as you noted, published some books about it, which is fascinating to me. So something one of my colleagues said, Sonia Simone, I just quoted in that article, learners make the best teachers. And I think, you know, to start to turn toward maybe some of the solutions to overcoming the imposter experience, I think that stuck out to me because so often in advice that we read about imposter experience, they talk about kind of getting a gauge on what you're, or understanding specifically kind of like what your actual level of expertise is.
Yeah.
And then from there, turning around and by teaching others about kind of what you know at the level that you're at, you can actually lend credibility, for instance, to whatever it is that you are writing about.
Right. And also I think in that situation, you may find out if there's gaps in your knowledge as well. When you go to try to explain it to someone, hey, maybe I need a little refresher in this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think especially too, for writers maybe who are just starting out or at a point in their career where they, you know, they aren't certain, that they can get to the kind of the next level or the zenith that they would like to, that recognizing that there always will be other experts that are going to be smarter and more skilled than you are, that to maybe to try to rewire some of that self-doubt or anxiety that comes from not thinking you're the greatest, because you're never going to be
Never going to know it. Right. And then I think part of that too, if you're preparing for a job interview, a talk or whatever, practice saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, that's all right.
I think one great image that I came away with when I was looking at kind of studying some of the imposter syndrome stuff was that we think that we should know everything about a subject when in truth, nobody knows everything about a subject.
If you're an expert, you should be able to answer every question.
Right. You know, when in truth, we're all kind of in our own little filter bubbles, but that's not probably not the best term to use, but we're all in our own little bubble of you know, expertise. Yeah.
We're all down our own rabbit hole.
Exactly. Yeah. But they all overlap.
Yeah.
And that overlapping is actually where innovation is mm-hmm. born.
Right.
Is by not only sharing your knowledge with others, but absorbing maybe what that piece of the bubble that they have.
And seeing how your knowledge relates to someone else's field.
That's right. And that's where creativity is born, right?
Absolutely.
That's taking, big, taking to
your knowledge and applying it to a new situation.
Exactly. Yeah. Two disparate kind of ideas and then marrying them into something completely new. So some of the takeaways I thought were interesting from, you know, the American Psychological Association had listed on their website, just a handful of kind of takeaways. And I thought, so speaking with your mentors to get supportive and encouraging supervision.
Absolutely.
That's important. Also, I think, you know, for writers specifically, is staying open-minded that, you know, there is something new to learn, or, you know, taking a class or just rapping with other writers.
Yes.
Can always open your eyes to something new. And then we talked about recognizing your level of expertise.
I think practicing that's important. That's what scientists do a lot. Before someone has a talk, it gets rehearsed a lot just within the lab. So, you know, before they go give a big talk, and, you know, we'll have a lab meeting and someone will present their talk, and those can be some of the harshest critics, right? These are going to be the people that are most familiar with the research and are going to ask you the hardest questions. So get your colleagues together and run it by them and tell them to kind of give you a hard time, you know, ask me the hard questions. And
Yeah. I mean, the next couple go kind of hand in hand, but, you know, being able to let go of unhealthy perfectionism, that's a big one, I think.
Just if you're an expert, doesn't mean you know everything.
Letting go of unhealthy perfectionism and celebrating small victories as opposed to, you know, I think when I'm thinking specifically about a longer piece of writing,
right?
Like giving yourself a pat on the back, maybe when you finish your small word count, opposed to, and I'll just go back to kind of Austin Kleon's advice about, you know, writing a page each day doesn't seem like much, but do it for 365 days and you've got enough to fill a novel, and you do it for your whole life and you have a career.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the other big takeaways. It was just, you know, like becoming a lifelong learner, realizing, you know, where you're at on your journey.
Keep writing, keep reading.
Keep going.
This gets back to our approach, avoidance motivated idea, right?
Right.
You know, recognize those small successes. You know, I did accomplish something today. I wrote a page, and realize that's a success, and help out with that approach motivation.
Yeah. I mean, just one foot in front of the other, reframing your thinking about, you know, those little steps as opposed to, you know, I'm never going to finish this novel. I think there was another novelist, Emma Donahue, an Oscar nominated author of Room, who was saying she meets so many young novelists who have written one third of a novel or many thirds of a novel, but can never actually finish a novel because they get about a third of the way in and they realize it's not working.
Right.
So I think her advice was the importance of outlining. Adam Skolnick, journalist who's been on this show a handful of times, also talks about that importance of breaking down that infinite blank page into little chunks so that your brain can experience those small satisfactory wins once you just finish a little piece.
Right. And the outline also is going to help you organize things in a logical manner, and things will have a better flow. And I think that's important to our brains, to have things laid out in a way that's connected.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think just getting started is a big one. I found an analogy recently that I thought was a great productivity hack from this author, James Clear, which I'll link to. He wrote a piece called The Physics of Productivity, Newton's Laws of Getting Stuff Done. And I especially resonated with just the first one. He takes Newton's law of first law, applies it to productivity and kind of the science of just getting started. This may not be neuroscience per se, but just that. Okay, so here's the, here I'll just quote the piece. Objects at rest tend to stay at rest, and objects in motion tend to stay in motion. So when it comes to being productive, this means one thing. The most important thing is to find a way to get started. And once you get started, it's much easier to stay in motion.
Keep that momentum.
So again, a page a day, 365 days, they add up. And
the page a day keeps the writer's block away.
There you go. And the imposter experience at bay. Oh,
there we go.
Rhymed. Yeah, I love that. Anyway, getting started is a big one. And I think, you know, if you're still in a funk and you're still unable to let go of that experience, it's probably important to talk to not only your mentors, but maybe a therapist if it's still really dogging you.
Yeah, that's like I said, extreme anxiety can overwhelm our brain. So, you know, the brain really isn't this linear machine. It's not like,
right.
It's not like, you know, you just get this activity change in the striatum and it's like a row of dominoes falling over.
Yeah.
But kind of stress increases, neuronal activity will be changed across many areas kind of simultaneously. And as it gets more and more pronounced, it's going to result in a mental state that is really less favorable for memory retrieval and cognitive flexibility and the things we need to write accurately.
Yeah.
And it'll be more favorable for like kind of habitual and reflexive behaviors. So if you're getting to that point when anxiety is overwhelming and you're getting angry and very impulsive when you're trying to write, then yeah, it's probably a good idea to get some therapy, talk to an MD,
yeah,
a counselor, and get that anxiety under control.
Absolutely. You know, it's always enlightening to speak with you about it. And, you know, I think one of the other interesting things I read recently was that like so many writers do not have like those advanced degrees. And, you know, our writing, you know, specifically when I'm thinking about journalism or, you know, when you're covering a subject that you might not be the subject matter expert in, I think the main takeaway for me is that you don't necessarily have to be the subject matter expert,
right,
to sound like an expert. You don't have to have that PhD to sound smart. And there's also, you know, there's no way.
You're not supposed to be. No. Yeah, you can't be as a journalist.
There's no way a journalist is going to be able to, you know, absorb a PhD level education, right, on a subject. And that's where kind of remaining flexible and, you know, not being hard on yourself,
right,
is important.
And you're not in it alone too. You know, there's people who are going to check your work and,
yeah,
and
absolutely. Yeah. So the desire to keep learning from those who may know more than you, and a passion also to then turn around and share that knowledge with those who may know less than you. I don't know. Right. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I feel like a fraud.
Are you an imposter?
You don't make me feel like a fraud. I make myself feel like a fraud. No, I think, yeah. So reframing, rewiring, probably just important to remember that these are doable things. It's just important, mm-hmm, piece of taking a step back.
And it's normal too. I think that's a big thing for people to understand that this, again, back to the, you know, if it is 70% of the population feels this thing, but
yeah,
anxiety is normal. There are some good aspects to it.
Right.
Too much is bad, but what you're going through is not a rare or strange phenomenon. It's natural.
Yeah.
If it gets too extreme, then yeah, go get some help.
Yeah. But talking to your peers and talking to your spouse or whomever about it, always kind of lessens the impact of that anxiety. So yeah, man, thank you so much for taking the afternoon to chat with me about this experience, mm-hmm, that so many of us have. And yeah, is there any other takeaways you want to leave before we sign off on this one? Or do you feel like we've
Covered it? Yeah. Yeah. But it's just, yeah, again, that idea that you are getting this, as anxiety increases, you're getting this shift in neuronal activity that really favors impulsive behaviors.
Yeah.
And just remember that and do what you can to avoid it.
I'm with you. Of course.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Yeah. This is an interesting topic. It got me sort of out of my comfort zone a little.
For sure, for sure. I'm sure we could talk about it more, but I'll have you back to talk about something else soon.
All right.
And yeah, I'll link to the imposter syndrome piece I wrote, how a famous robot test can help you beat imposter syndrome. All of those tips are actually kind of baked into that one. And appreciate it. And
yeah, thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, what's that? And we can actually fist bump here in the studio.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're close enough. Look at that. Not 1,000 miles apart.
Thanks so much for joining us for a glimpse into the workings of the writer's brain. For more episodes of The Writer Files, or to simply leave us a comment or a question, drop by writerfiles.fm. You can always chat with me on Twitter @KeltonReed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.